Ladies and gentlemen, this is the last general session of the symposium. The committee in charge of the plans and preparations in planning the arrangement and order, we're very eager that the last session provide an opportunity, the last general session, provide an opportunity for the members and participants to hear someone with a broad acquaintanceship with the problems of arms control and disarmament. We were delighted then when we received from Senator Humphrey an affirmative reply to our request that he come to speak at this session. Senator Humphrey has been, since 1955, the chairman of the Senate Subcommittee on Disarmament. He was the chief sponsor of the bill creating the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. Long before they were established, he continually urged the convening of the Geneva Test Ban Conference. He has, as a member, chairman of the subcommittee, been responsible for the initiation of studies on various aspects of disarmament, the latest of which is entitled The Economic Impact of Arms Control Agreements. It is particularly with respect to the economic consequences and implications of disarmament that Senator Humphrey has decided to deal today. He has indicated his willingness to answer questions after his remarks. With great pleasure, it's a great honor to introduce to you Senator Humphrey.
Thank you very much. I'm most pleased to be invited to participate in this outstanding symposium. I must say that I recognize that I'm speaking to a very distinguished audience, men and women that have expertise knowledge in the field of arms control and disarmament, the political aspects, the technical, the military, and the economic aspects of the whole subject matter of the arms control and indeed even the armament program. Now, my only regret in speaking to this audience is the fact that my talk unavoidably pulls down the curtain on the final act of what I gather has been a rather stellar performance. I was not privileged to hear many of the fine addresses by my predecessors on this platform. Therefore, what I may say today may be a bit redundant or repetitious. You'll just have to forgive me for it. Neither did I have the benefit of taking part in the stimulating discussions that marked the technical sessions of the past 3 days. I do have a copy of the program that I looked over this morning on the airplane as I came out here, and it is a program rich with subject matter, controversial subjects, and the possibility of gaining information such as I've never witnessed before. But from a second-hand acquaintance of this conference and the work of the symposium to date, I can state categorically that this conference is a milestone in the history of the public discussion of disarmament and arms control. The initiators and the organizers of the symposium, the Bendix Systems Division, and the University of Michigan deserve our thanks, our commendation, and our praise for bringing together in this unique fashion the men and the women from the universities, from industry, from labor, and from government, for a wide-ranging discussion of the most serious issues before the world today. And I suggest we give our sponsors of this symposium a good hand of thankful applause. Whether we like it or not, our society for decades to come will be shaped by the actions and the interactions of the academic, of industrial and government communities. It is well, therefore, that the members of these communities begin to think of themselves as a team, pulling together in the same direction, instead of, so to speak, as an unharnessed troika. I might add that it would be very helpful if this conference would speak to the Congress of the United States about the subject of disarmament and arms control. They're a little tired of listening to me. I've noticed that my voice in the Congress on this subject, at least, and I hope it's no further than that, is beginning to produce diminishing returns. There was once when we had a staff in the Congress of the United States working on the subject of arms control and disarmament. There was one time that we had a special subcommittee authorized by an act of Congress. I regret to report to you that because of the jurisdictional difficulties that we have in the Congress, amongst other problems that shall go unmentioned and unnamed, the work of the Subcommittee on Disarmament has been sorely limited. I do not believe that you can conduct technical work of this nature in Congress or out of Congress without technical staff. And regrettably, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee doesn't have any technical staff in this subject matter. Ever since we lost the most able and competent person that I can think of in this field, Miss Betty Goetz, who has now gone over to the executive branch of the government in the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, the Congress of the United States has wobbled along with limited hearings, depending entirely upon the busy schedule of senators with part-time work from general staff members of a foreign relations committee. Now, that's the lobbying that I'm going to do on you. And if you really think the Congress ought to interest itself in this subject matter, why don't you speak to them? You represent citizenry, and I could use some help. But more importantly, the subject and the subject matter needs the continuous, conscientious, expertise help of technical staff in the Congress of the United States. Now, nowhere is this matter of the teamwork that I spoke about more evident than in the case of disarmament and arms control. As one of your speakers, Mr. Kenneth Boulding, so incisively put to you in your banquet on Tuesday night, the major problem before our society today is a grievous misallocation of our intellectual resources. I want to thank him for that forthright statement. And may I say to those of the business community, and I would hope to develop this point a little more later on, that unless something is done in this country about the research dollar that your government is allocating and spending to make some more of that research dollar available for the private peacetime sector of our economy, the American industrial system is going to be priced out of the market. It's going to find itself second rate in another decade, and it will find itself losing foreign trade and foreign opportunities, and the balance of payment problems for this government will be far beyond anything that we've witnessed today. If you want to talk about the economics of arms control, you could concentrate this entire symposium upon the subject matter of what are we doing with the research dollars in America today. And then go and ask yourself what other people are doing with their research dollars. Now, this isn't all on the paper. I had to get this material together rather quickly by long distance and double-checking with staff members. So I have the habit of wandering away from what was once a well-prepared script to give a rather poorly prepared speech. So, this coming year, I'm going to be holding some hearings and publish a report on the matter of research, industrial research, basic research, applied research, military and non-military on the part of several countries. And my preliminary investigation shows me that the major threat to American exports today is not in the common market as an institution, but rather what countries are spending to improve product. Our friends in West Germany, for example, are spending 4/5 of their research dollar on improving peacetime product. We're spending 3/5 of our entire research dollar on the military. And the Russians are spending about the same amount or a little bit more. So the two superpowers are apt to be priced right smack bang out of the market in another decade. The Japanese are spending 4/5 of their research dollar in broad figures on peacetime production. Maybe this is one of the reasons they can outsell us around the world and produce a good and at times a superior product. Take a look at what the Belgians are doing, the Dutch, and a few others. And then ask yourself what we ought to be doing. Or maybe we should ask ourselves what the president did the other night. Are the other partners in the alliance really bearing their full share of the burden? It isn't just the end product that is important. It is the research product. And it goes right back to what we were talking about here a moment ago, when Mr. Kenneth Boulding put it so well, that the major problem before our society today is the grievous misallocation of our intellectual resources. Now, coming from an important and agricultural state, I have to take exception with one of the statements of Mr. Boulding. I cannot agree with him, unreservedly that is, that we know too much about agriculture. As a matter of fact, may I say most respectfully to the distinguished speaker of Tuesday's banquet, that the greatest success story that the United States has today is not in its missiles or in its atomic energy, but it's in its agriculture. That is the number one productive miracle of the world. We certainly could use some careful research, however, in better ways of utilization of agricultural product, and also in consumption of agricultural production, or better still, into ways of bringing our farming techniques to peoples who still use the wooden plows of their ancestors. The point is well taken, however, that we have an embarrassment of riches in certain fields, while our perception of social realities often seems to lag far behind. I had a press conference in Washington yesterday, having just returned within the last 36 hours from a 3.5 weeks tour in Latin America, visiting some 7 countries. I've been hard at work. I've been in the backcountry and the mountains in the most underprivileged, poverty-stricken areas of the world. And as I said yesterday, that for some peculiar reason, the men who design policy for us and who frequently implement it are experts in finance and industry and have forgot what a rake or a hoe or a plow looks like. 2/3 of the world's population, in fact, 3/5 of the world's four-fifths of the world's population is rural. The problems of the world are not in the big industrial cities. They're in the backcountry. And regrettably, most of our foreign aid program has spent its energy and its wealth upon industry rather than upon rural rehabilitation. And the Alliance for Progress, as I said yesterday, will succeed or fail, not on what you do with the making of a steel plant, but what you do in terms of agricultural rehabilitation. What can you do to make life a little better for the campesino, for the peasant, for the farmer? If you can't do something about that, just fold up your tent and get ready for the worst of all things, the end of our kind of civilization. That's another speech. I just thought I'd touch you up on that one in case you want to invite me back another year from now. Well, now I'm going to stay with my topic as much as I can. I think it would be rather futile to try to articulate a consensus of the diverse points of view which have found expression in your deliberations thus far. The subject of arms control, one that has been all too little explored in the years gone by, is essentially hypothetical at this stage. And to the extent that the problem is hypothetical, There's every reason to avoid dogmatism and artificial synthesis or even conclusions relating to opposing points of view. Rather, what I should like to do in the time that I'm permitted to have with you is to place before you my thoughts on certain of the economic aspects of arms control and disarmament. Now, one aspect of these economic considerations is external to the United States. The other is internal, and neither, in my view, is given sufficient weight either among policymakers in Washington or among the many public groups directly concerned with arms control and disarmament. Now, let me start with the external aspects, or the external aspects of the economic impact of disarmament. We've so accustomed ourselves to the arms race. We've been at it now since 1940, 20-some years. A whole generation has become accustomed to it and have so passively accepted its costs in terms of resources and personnel that we run the danger of assuming that other countries can reconcile these costly arms budgets for themselves with their own limited economies. Remember, my fellow citizens, that there has been no Congress that's voted a reduction in the arms budget. Remember that the Congress, which is the representative institution of the American people, finds it possible to add to the requests of the President and the Bureau of the Budget under either administration, Republican or Democratic, which I think proves my point that we've become so accustomed to the arms race that even when the experts come before us, the best experts that we have with a budget, that members of Congress find it politically desirable, politically convenient, in fact, almost mandatory, to add to the budget, and not one complaint. I've received thousands of letters from constituents and many more from people that are not my constituents when I've asked for a few more dollars for a subject like housing or education or public health, calling me a dangerous wastrel and spender. And I can honestly say that with the exception possibly of a pacifist group, I have yet to receive a letter from a constituent saying, I think you voted too much for arms control. And I get a lot of mail. I mean, for arms, for the armaments. My mail runs 1,000 letters a day on the average. And I have a pretty good idea what they're thinking. So the fact remains that we in this country judge arms costs and arms budgets from habit now. And I repeat that we have very little realization of what this means to others who attempt to get in on the act, so to speak, or attempt to be part of what seems to be the pattern of the day. Now, leaving aside for the moment the extent of the burden of the arms race on the United States, and we'll come to that, there's an undeniable burden on many, many other countries. For any evidence on this subject, all we need to do is to look no further than the plight of democratic India, which finds itself today in the toils of a military buildup, just at the moment when every spare rupee should go towards the fulfillment of its economic plans. The current Indian 5-year plan, never a sure thing even under the best of circumstances, with tremendous outside assistance, looks increasingly like the main victim of Chinese aggression. And that may very well have been the purpose of the aggression. I believe Kenneth Boulding mentioned this fact that $120 billion is spent annually on the war industry throughout the world, and that's a rough estimate, and that this is greater than the annual income of the poorer half of the world. Now, this is unquestionably a shocking waste of human resources and material resources. The more so as none of the smaller underdeveloped countries can buy with its military dollar more than a facade of security, or at least passing security against a small neighboring power. It certainly cannot buy security against any medium-sized or large-scale aggression in the nuclear age. Now, what alternative then is there for the underdeveloped country which wishes to avoid the long being drawn into this arms race, which wishes to devote its resources to the benefit of its people? I submit that part of our answer lies in the encouragement of arms control agreements in specific parts of the world. I believe this ought to become a part of our total concept of what we call mutual assistance. Because, ladies and gentlemen, I've traveled a great deal as a member of the Congress, and I work at these travels, and I have found where our economic assistance has more than been offset in country after country, underdeveloped countries, by the expenditure for arms which are obsolete, ineffective, and at best only give, as I said, the facade, the impression of any degree of security. Arms control arrangements may be pursued along two different but related paths. The major powers may, and I think should, try negotiating first among themselves and then encourage other powers to participate in whatever agreements are reached. Now, this is the rationale behind the test ban negotiations, which have been going on for many years and at the present time. And I want to say we're going to continue those negotiations, and I'm hopeful we'll continue to press for at least some degree of acceptance. The United States, Britain, and the Soviet Union are attempting to agree first among themselves. If they finally resolve their remaining differences, the resulting agreement will then be submitted to other countries for their signature and observance. Now, the drawback to this approach, as we've seen particularly since 1958, is the amount of time consumed in arriving at agreement among the great powers. Time spent in attempting to bridge the small but vital differences over issues such as inspection and verification. This has clearly diminished the chances for ready acceptance of a nuclear test ban by third and fourth countries. I don't want my remarks to be misinterpreted. I think we must pursue this course, nevertheless. But it is a difficult one, and we ought to appreciate that fact. But a second, virtually untested way of controlling armaments and approaching into disarmament is one of special agreements among countries in a particular region. I've advocated this for years. Such agreements would conceivably be backed up by commitments on the part of the major powers to observe the agreements. The major powers would either formally adhere to these pacts or perhaps would sign separate protocols to the same effect. We should have been pursuing this course, particularly in the Middle East, with vigor, with purpose, with continuity. We should have been pursuing it for years in Africa before it's too late. And I'm going to discuss with you what I believe is another area that in which we can profitably pursue, the regional approach to disarmament and arms control. Now, there's no point in my arguing that either of these approaches, that is, the big power approach or the regional approach, is inherently superior. My position is that we should try them both simultaneously, independently, jointly, or by whatever means seems most likely to be successful. Be a bit pragmatic. To date, at least one attempt has been made to carry out the first path, that of the initial great power agreement, whereas the path of regional arms control agreements remains untried and untrodden. I think it's time to take a look at some possible new course of action. Indeed, I'm disturbed and concerned that the regional arms control approach has received so little attention from our government and from other governments, students of arms control, and the public at large. And it's high time to study the feasibility of regional arms control agreements, which, among other things, means sounding out the governments in the areas under consideration and following up on those lines of approach which seem most promising. Now, I don't want to be misunderstood here. I do not say that regional disarmament or regional arms control will prevent World War III or will prevent a confrontation of major of the superpowers. I merely say that it will bring some benefits to humanity. And it might very well bring some benefits to the countries that are attempting to help humanity. It might even bring some benefits to countries that are not attempting to help humanity. With all due respect for the contention that the policy of this administration should be disarmament and not arms control, we would be guilty of gross neglect if we were to pursue the objective of worldwide disarmament to such a degree and with such tenacity that we ignored the potential of arms control in a smaller spectrum. Now, gentlemen and ladies, I see no reason to get into a big argument between the specialists around here as to whether or not we ought to be just talking about disarmament, worldwide, universal, and general, or whether we ought to be talking exclusively about arms control. Most people talk too much anyhow, and there's plenty of room to talk about both subjects at the same time. And one of the real problems about this whole subject matter of disarmament and arms control is that we know so little about it, we become very dogmatic about what little point of view we have. We become experts in a new kind of theology. Not quite sure exactly where it's going to take us or what it means. I suggest that we loosen up a bit and accommodate ourselves to one another. If you're ever going to be able to get disarmament, you ought to be able to disarm each other's intellectual stubbornness enough so that you can talk sensibly about both subjects, disarmament and arms control, which are surely related. You don't have to take that if you don't want to, but that's my point of view. Now, we were not deterred from creating regional defense pacts in all areas of the world only a few years ago. We did this despite the impossibility of creating a defense pact covering the whole world. First, we joined the Rio Pact of Latin America, then came NATO. This was followed by CETO in Eastern and Southeastern Asia, and finally, the Middle Eastern Defense Pact, CENTO, was formed with our active interest, if not our direct participation. I never was able quite to understand just why we were connected with that, but I have a feeling we are. The United States understands the concept, therefore, of regional defense. So do other nations. It appears to me that since national defense and disarmament and arms control are the opposite sides of the same coin of national security, that a nation that understands so well regional defense might also understand regional disarmament or arms control. The United States was so pact happy in this past decade that any country which did not want to join a defense pact with us was often looked down upon as being positively unfriendly, or at least unwisely neutral. Now, with each new pact, the United States shipped out more and more arms to its growing list of allies. We have some 42 mutual defense pacts today, with another 15 or 20 nations that are somewhat closely allied. Now, most, of course, of these arms went to Europe, but we were also supplying arms to many countries in Asia, and to some extent, and in a growing extent, to Latin America and in the Middle East. In the Middle East, we have witnessed the frustration accompanying our efforts to hold down the local arms race with one hand while helping to feed it with the other. Now, fairness compels me to say, and I'm pleased to say it, that these arms were never supplied indiscriminately. They were always intended to bolster the ability of the recipient country to defend itself against external aggression, to maintain its threatened independence. The arms were not supposed to be used against other friendly powers. We had this all written out in the arms agreements. Nor to suppress internal freedom, nor to give the recipient nation any special privilege or special prestige, which it might otherwise have lacked. Yet it is no secret that sometimes these unwanted results sprang from our military assistance programs all around the world. And once that arms have been supplied to a country, it is never easy to stop the demand if the need is no longer present, if there are other ways to meet it. I shall never forget a personal conversation that I had with the late Secretary of State John Foster Dulles when we were discussing a certain area of the world in which we were sending arms. I had visited this area of the world. He was kind enough to ask me to come over and sit down with him and discuss some of my observations. I went to his home for this visit. And I shall long remember the look in his face and the sadness in his voice when he said, "You know, Hubert, at once that you have extended military aid to one country, the other country demands it from you. And once you have sent tanks to one country, another country wants tanks, whether they know how to use them or not. And it becomes one of the most costly enterprises we've ever experienced." And what I was trying to say here a moment ago is that it's not too difficult to start the arms program or the military assistance program, but it's very difficult to terminate it, even when it's no longer needed. Now, my remarks should not be interpreted as an attack against military assistance, because I vote for military assistance in light of the kind of a world in which we live. But I do not consider it an end unto itself, nor do I consider it something that we ought not to be able to re-examine in light of new conditions. I merely point out how difficult it is to turn off the spigot. You take a look at our budget for it, and you'll see what I mean. In my view, there's only one readily apparent alternative to all of this. The concept of regional security, maintained by means of arms control, in place of or in addition to heavy armaments programs. By encouraging the concept of regional security, we would be saying to other countries something we've been saying at home over the past few years, namely that arms control and arms production are two sides of the coin of national security policy. We have derived all that we can from armaments in the absence of arms control. Now, what remains to be seen is whether arms control might in fact lessen the need for arms. I think it will. And I believe we ought to make a serious effort at this particular approach. As I said a moment ago, in the past 3.5 weeks, I visited some 7 Latin American and Central American nations bordering on the Caribbean. I've talked with the presidents of each of these nations, the foreign ministers, the finance ministers. I've been in the Congress of 3 of them, met with the committees of foreign relations of the committee of each of these Congresses. I believe that I've explored in depth, as far as one could in that limited period of time, the thinking of the people and the leaders of these Caribbean Central American republics, including Venezuela and Mexico. Now, a primary topic of conversation with the leaders and the people of these countries was the problem of the physical security of the vast region south of the Rio Grande. In fact, this subject matter was so close to their lives, to their thinking, that I'm sure that it was distracting them from the job of economic rehabilitation and economic progress and social improvement that ought to be taking place in these countries. In other words, the fear of attack, the fear of subversion, the fear of revolution, of disorder, all of which has been augmented by the flow of arms into this area, primarily into Cuba, but as well as into other countries. This has, in a very real sense, weakened the programs of economic progress, or weakened the possibility of the fulfillment of the Alliance for Progress. I'm convinced that the leaders in these countries, from these conversations, do not want nuclear warheads and delivery systems or delivery vehicles stored on their soil or readied for use in any other part of Latin America. The conclusion is inescapable that the United States, in concert with its sister republics in this, the Western Hemisphere, has a solemn obligation and a great opportunity to encourage hemispheric-wide agreement banning the manufacture, the storage, the testing, and the combat use of nuclear arms and delivery systems in Latin America. The area is ripe for this type of pact, a pact embodying these principles, and a pact that goes beyond just denuclearization, a pact that gets right at the problem of staged disarmament, better termed arms control. Now, only recently, the entire security of the Western Hemisphere was threatened by the deployment of long-range Soviet missiles and bombers in Cuba. Through firmness and a creditable demonstration of our willingness, if need be, to use force, and through skillful diplomacy on the part of the President of the United States and his officers, our government secured the removal of these offensive hostile weapons. And we don't want them back in any place. And I'm willing to bet that no one anywhere in this half of the world wants them back either. A denuclearized Latin America should be high on the priority list of Latin American diplomatic goals in 1963. Agreement on the establishment of a denuclearized zone should be worked out by the Latin American countries themselves, just as the formal proposal of such a zone was usefully made by Brazil in recent weeks. The United States, however, is just as concerned as any of the Latin American nations as to whether nuclear weapons are to be introduced into that area of the Latin American area of this hemisphere. We acted in Cuba the way we did because there was no alternative. But an agreement to keep nuclear weapons out of the Latin American area and to subject this agreement to adequate verification offers a hopeful way of preventing further incidents like the recent Cuban crisis. I insist that we give some leadership to this project and not merely tacit approval with a statement from a spokesman for the State Department. We ought to embrace it. We ought to make it a primary objective. It would be good to have a few successes upon our national standard in the field of disarmament and arms control. A denuclearized zone in Latin America could be negotiated through the Organization of American States. This is a functioning organization which has been surprisingly effective in handling hemispheric problems. The OAS, if it wished, might call upon the United Nations or the United States in particular for special services or assistance in connection with the implementation of such a denuclearized zone. The United Nations, for instance, might suggest some of the personnel for the Zone Control Commission in the event that the OAS decided some non-regional personnel should be involved in implementing that agreement. The OAS could give regular progress reports to the UN in the operations of the verification system so that other UN members could profit by the experience in Latin America. And by the way, I think we need some experience in verification and inspection rather than just argument about it and hypothetical argument as well as theory. The United States could assist the OAS by helping to train inspectors in the verification techniques. This would present few, if any, problems since the United States is already a leading member of the Organization of American States. To be effective, however, any agreement on a denuclearized zone in Latin America has to be subject to adequate verification. I regret to say that many of the proposals for verifications of arms control or disarmament measures, that none has yet advanced to the stage of adoption, not to speak of implementation. In Cuba, the United States and the Soviet Union successfully disengaged themselves from the mortal danger of nuclear war, at least for the present. But this restraint on the part of the two greatest powers may provide little more than a breathing spell unless an essential step is taken towards a permanent settlement of the Cuban crisis, namely unambiguous verification of the removal of Soviet missiles and bombers as provided for in the historic understanding between President Kennedy and Chairman Khrushchev. If Fidel Castro is allowed to frustrate the will of powerful world leaders, if on-site inspection remains a dead letter in the case of Cuba, then how can we assume that it will succeed anywhere else? This is one of the reasons that verification and inspection in Cuba is so vital. Not merely because that somebody may have sneaked a missile back into the mountains or have hidden away a plane. But more importantly, because if you can't gain inspection here so as to have some degree of credibility to a program of arms control and disarmament, so that we can have some assurance that it's more than a promise, then I submit that the whole subject matter of disarmament and arms control has suffered a serious defeat and may very well never succeed. This is why I believe we should press this issue relentlessly in and out of the OAS, in and out of the United Nations. And I repeat, it's not merely because I believe that weaponry may be secretly hidden away, but more importantly, because this is a test case on whether or not you will ever be able to get any type of verification that is reliable. Now, don't misunderstand me again. I agree that aerial inspection at least offers a considerable amount of verification. But I also know that it is not adequate if you want genuine inspection. It can provide, in the instance possibly of Cuba, some degree of safety in terms of an arms control agreement or any other form of agreement. But in the superpower struggle, it is not adequate because the areas of the world are too big, the geography and the topography too complicated. Now, a denuclearized zone in Latin America should, if possible, lead to the creation of a zone emptied of conventional weapons as well. Any curbing of the amount of arms going to Latin American nations under effective and balanced safeguards would have a healthy impact on the economies of the countries in that area. There isn't a single country in Latin America that can afford to buy a Colt 45, much less a cannon or a plane. Not one. There isn't a single country in Latin America that can even afford a military exercise. Not one. And yet each of them is busily engaged, with the possible exception of Costa Rica, in buying arms. And we have yet failed to place the matter of regional arms control, disarmament, and a denuclearized zone on a priority agenda. I'm giving this speech primarily today because I feel that if I shout loud enough and create enough commotion, it may be a subject of discussion when President Kennedy goes to Costa Rica in the month of March. I think something needs to be done about it, unless you want to buy all the arms for them. I repeat that our government should encourage the Latin American nations to make arms controls make any arms control agreement as broad as possible, so as to limit the large amount of funds which are so often wastefully devoted to armaments. The current situation in which the smaller countries compete for military forces which are too large for their immediate needs and far too expensive to be maintained with outside assistance is deplorable. And my fellow Americans, every time you give 6 or 5 destroyers or corvettes or whatever it is to these particular countries, they have a budgetary deficit and you've got to make that up. Now, if you give them to one country, you've got to give them to another, or you're playing favorites. Now, there is at least one area in the world that we can guarantee protection to alone. That's in this hemisphere, if it's a matter of military security that they're concerned about. And there is one area in the world that we're intimately acquainted with that cannot afford hardly the expense of an adequate police system, much less a military system, and that's Latin America. And there's one area in the world in which we're going to put in the next 10 years, $20 billion, according to the commitments of our government and our people from the public and private sector. That's Latin America. I think it's about time that the American taxpayer asked a question. Are these old-fashioned, conventional, obsolete armaments necessary? That's what they're getting, you know. But they still kill, and they still offer a threat to a neighbor. The whole subject matter of arms assistance to Latin America requires immediate executive and congressional scrutiny. And it isn't good enough for just the United States to take this initiative. This is why I've said it must be done in the OAS. Because if we were to deny certain countries military assistance, they can get it someplace else. We've got to arrive at some kind of a hemispheric agreement on this matter, and quickly. Or I am here to say to you, in the knowledge that I've gained as a student of Latin American economics, and not a good one, but at least about average. Most people don't know much about it at all, so you can be average without knowing too much. I'm here to say that we will weaken and possibly cause the failure of the Alliance for Progress and all that it means unless something is done to supplement it by effective arms control and the limitation of armament in this area.